Okay, welcome everybody. Today's Vasika Day is focused around the Thai forest tradition, and it's under the kind of the topic or the overriding theme of devotion and ritual. In the sense that, you know, I think sometimes when we take that theme of devotion and ritual, it tends to be something a bit more ceremonial. But you know, I was really thinking as we were developing the themes for this year that certainly in terms of Thai tradition and the Thai approach to practice, I mean, there's a real devotional element to the teachers in the tradition. And to be able to maybe highlight that a bit this Upasika Day. Also, what stimulated it was during the winter retreat this year. Each winter retreat we tend to pick some sort of a theme and then pursue it. The theme that we picked up was the Thai forest tradition, sort of like going back to the roots. I think, you know, generally it seemed to elicit a real sense of appreciation and acknowledgement and a certain devotion to the tradition that we belong to. And I think particularly for Westerners who are, you know, in contact with us as a monastery, then there's an assumption that somehow there's it's sort of like the Thai forest tradition is actually what you're is a standard. It's what's actually there in Buddhism in Thailand, and that's not the case. Probably the forest tradition comprises, you know, a minuscule percentage really of the monasteries that are in Thailand, and the spectrum of and flavor that is a part of the tradition there. It's, a lot of it is just custom and tradition. Some of it is scholastic and study. Some of it is ceremonial and ritual. And some of it is practice in terms of meditation practice. But then there's a forest tradition that gives a flavor of certain simplicity and focus on training, and particularly having a high standard of maintaining of the discipline. It was like Debbie went to one of the monasteries in the Bay Area with the monks. There was a couple of the monks, or a few of the monks went and to pay respects to a senior administrative monk who was in the Bay Area and at one of the monasteries, and Debbie was surprised because there's a lot of senior monks there, and then there was just the lay people who were just sort of throwing money at the monks, and then there was the afternoon, and there was this kind of a whole kind of ice cream and yogurt fest, and it was you know, a very different flavor than what she's used to. But that's ordinary, and what we do is kind of out of the ordinary. So to highlight the tradition, I think, you know, certainly within the forest tradition, it's always gone in cycles of say popularity and falling into disuse, and then kind of rising again, and so that there's through history there's always been this ups and downs of a practice tradition. And say today's there, I would say that there is a real strong popularity of in Thailand, and which is sort of being generated outside of the boundaries of Thailand, for the seeing the importance of the practice tradition, and so that's something that I think would be very much attributable to a monk called Ajahn Mun. And this is his picture up here. He was he was born in 1870, died in 1949, but he generated a huge number of students and disciples, and he was a exemplary teacher. And it wasn't until the last few years of his life that he actually stayed in the same monastery consecutive years. He was a wandering monk, and still he drew, you know, very large numbers of practitioners to him. And then certainly Ajahn Chah was inspired by him and practiced following other teachers that trained under Ajahn Mun, and so that the tradition really owes a great debt of gratitude to Ajahn Mun's real fierce commitment to training and seeking whether or not these teachings actually gave fruit in the way that is in the suttas, because that wasn't the popular belief at the time. It was sort of this was in the Dharma ending, it's a Dharma ending age, the best you can do is sort of make merit and hope for rebirth in the time of some future Buddha. And so that Ajahn Mun dispelled that belief and said, no, these teachings are valid in this present day. So that we inherit that that lineage, that perspective, and of course today what I want to do is explore some of the teachings of different teachers, beginning with Ajahn Mun, and then a direct student of Ajahn Mun, Ajahn Mahabhua, and then explore a few others that have been major influence in, say, our both in terms of Thailand as a whole, but then also coming back to us. And then we'll do readings and try to keep them fairly short, and then open it up to discussion, and then go on to another reading, open it up to discussion, have a break sometime, and end with a final reading by Ajahn Chah, and then have a final sitting. So that'd be the kind of how the afternoon will work. And Jeannie put together these notes for the Upasika Day, and so that there's some good background on the various teachers and lineage, which is helpful for people. So that and the resources to go back to. And then also go course, outside there's a variety of books that have been put out, as well as we did a DVD, collected together all of the readings that we did in the winter retreat, and they're on the, I think it's just sort of hot off the press sort of thing. They just completed it yesterday, finally. Today. So there was pressure to get it finished for this. And there's some great notes and whatnot. It's nicely laid out. So that's something to take back with you and to be able to listen. So maybe before I do the reading on Ajahn Mun, just to see if there's any questions just from that, that bit of an introduction. Yeah?
Curious what shaped the Thai forest tradition then to be different from David's flavor?
I would say the commitment to simplicity, commitment to the training under the Vinaya discipline, which is oftentimes it's like one of the scriptures, the suttas go back to early days of the Buddha, but then there's been various editions. The Abhidhamma, it really comes from a couple hundred years after, and it's sort of an extension of kind of Buddhist psychology and metaphysics. And the Vinaya, the rules of training and discipline, with all the stories of how it came about, I'd say it's pretty much very close to as it was laid down, because it was the first thing to be neglected. So that, it's held as a kind of a nice historical bit, but it wasn't really studied or put into practice. And bits of it would be taken out, but it was more like passed on with tradition. So that's certainly in the time of, those wax and wane over history. But certainly for Ajahn Mun, he would have come across it in studies, but then it sort of, you look and say, nobody's living like this. So then forest tradition tends to pick those themes up of training and really developing a lifestyle of practice as the Buddha laid it out. So that's it ends up being shifting away from a custom and tradition mode of relationship to the teachings, or an overly ceremonial, because even sometimes people would keep the rules, but it would be trying to keep the letter of the rule without understanding it as a training. So that recognizing, this is a fundamental part of training.
Pa, the relation between Thailand and Burma and Sri Lanka at the time of Ajahn Mun, was there really no contact at that time?
No. For all intents and purposes, zilch. there are some of the monks would have gone Tudong into Burma. One of Ajahn Chah's teachers certainly did, Ajahn Kinnerly. He Tudonged through up into the north, through Burma, into India, probably in 1920s, 1930s. But, communication being what it is, the you have to spend it long enough to learn the language. And there's no common language. So in reality, almost no contact. So there's very little interaction. You can't hop on a plane. So that, there's so much more interaction now, both through physical travel as well as through, say, books, through, the fifth king of Thailand was the first king to sponsor, and this is in the, probably 1880-something or other, 1890s, the first translations into English of the scriptures, and was quite an important motivator for the establishing the Pali Text Society. It's very nascent, the actual contact between the countries and the traditions.
Well, could you review the transmission of the ordination between Sri Lanka and Thailand? Was that like 1,000 years before? Or
there's a couple times where in the history of Thailand and of Sri Lanka that Sri Lanka monks came over in the time of Sukhothai, which probably in the 1300s, 1400s, and to establish an ordination lineage. Thailand went over in the late 1700s, early 1800s, established because of the decline and the inability to have confidence in the ordination lineage, that there wasn't enough monks that had any, that you could have the confidence in that they were really monks to establish an ordination lineage. So that went back, that over history, there's a few times where that happened. And but that was oftentimes more at the level of kings. It didn't come from your ordinary monk sort of deciding, oh, I'm going to get a bunch of monks together and start an ordination lineage. Sort of the king sort of says, well, this is really problematic, and we better send a delegation. They had the means to do that, and especially if they see themselves as... because that's always been sort of one of the duties of a responsible king was to protect the religion. And, it didn't always happen that way, but as a traditional element and perception.
Well, also, it doesn't involve Thailand so much, but I think that there was even an earlier exchange between Sri Lanka and Burma.
Yes.
For the same kind of thing.
Yes.
Before those times.
Yes, real early. Because there's also trade routes, India, Thailand, Sri Lanka, Burma. There's international trade routes that go back to 2,000, 3,000 years that they've always been trading. So that oftentimes you would have some of the traders, and that's also how Buddhism went up into the areas of Kashmir, Afghanistan, Silk Route up into China, was with traders. And similarly, really fascinating element of cotton. There's a particular strain of cotton in India that is far superior than anything ever was in Southeast Asia. And they also had larger looms, so that the width, the width of the looms was larger, and the quality of cotton was better, and they developed it. So there was a lot of trade in from India to Southeast Asia in cotton. And of course, then you know ideas and religion were carried through. That's how say there's a whole sort of Sriwijaya kingdom in Indonesia, and Borobudur was a Buddhist, the heart of a Buddhist kingdom. It was Mahayana Buddhism, but it was very early. But it followed trade routes. Anyway, that's historical. Yes, Pavel.
Could you say a few words about the structure of Thai Sangha and where a persecution fits there? Because I understand there is Makan Kaya, right, and Damayu, so there are like two disciples of school, and like where Thai first tradition fits there.
There's probably 85% of the Sangha in Thailand is what's called Mahan Kaya, but 15% are Damayu. Damayu is a reform sect that was initiated by the fourth king of Thailand. So in the 1850s, and then has always been sponsored by the different royal families and kings. And so it's very influential. But its focus was reform and holding to both the teachings and the Vinaya, so that Ajahn Mun was in the Damayu, and the vast majority of early forest tradition teachers were in the Damayu, and a couple of the early students of Ajahn Mun were Mahan Kaya. And Ajahn Chah studied under them. Ajahn Kinnerly, Ajahn Tonglat, Ajahn Chah studied under them. When Ajahn Chah went to visit Ajahn Mun, and that was one of the questions he had, was, should I be reordaining in the Damayu to live with you? Or what should I do? And Ajahn Mun's response was, Mahan Kaya needs good monks also.
Mm-hmm.
So he wasn't really fixed on the actual label, but was really encouraging good practice. And it's certainly prescient in the sense of seeing that the influence of Ajahn Chah has had broadening the reach of the forest tradition in Thailand and elsewhere.
So then technically you have idea belongs to Makan Kaya?
Yes. Yeah, although I don't really didn't want to bring sectarianism into America. Didn't want to incorporate that into part of the mission. Okay, so Ajahn Mun and it's really interesting, a lot of these early monks, Ajahn Mun's teacher was Ajahn Sao. Ajahn Sao was a forest monk. Ajahn Mun trained under him, but then Ajahn Mun, after his kind of enlightened experience, went back and taught Ajahn Sao. Mm-hmm. And then they both became great leaders. And actually, the relics of... we were offered, actually, by Ajahn Mahabua, who's a very senior disciple of Ajahn Mun, relics of, in there, Ajahn Mun, and there of Ajahn Sao. And in the the monastery where Ajahn Mun was cremated, that's probably where the largest collection of his relics are. And I don't know what it's like today, but when I went there, which was quite a while ago, 20, 30 years ago, you could actually see where the bones had been collected from the funeral pyre, and then they're transitioning into clear crystal. And many of them were already clear. Some of them were still in a period of transition, you could see. So it's something was very different about this monk. Okay, and then this, of course, Ajahn Mun died in 1949. There's very little that was, of course, recording equipment wasn't available. There's a few things were written down by, you know, written down by his disciples. And then later in his life, there was actually found a kind of a poem that he wrote, and it was actually named sort of like the Ballad of Liberation from the Khandas. And he wrote it, and it was written in pencil when it was found. So it was he didn't write it for publication. It was just sort of something that he wrote as an expression of his understanding and appreciation of Dhamma. Also, as a lay person, Ajahn Mun was an accomplished. In the northeast of Thailand, there's a style of like folk singing that is you have to be really quick, you have to be really clever, you have to be really very sharp and have a lot of knowledge. And he was really good at that. He's a Molong singer. So that he's using his love of language, because a lot of it is play on words and plays on ideas, and oftentimes it's kind of a combat back and forth, who can one up the other person. Anyway, it starts off as and I won't read it all, just sort of excerpts. Once there was a man who loved himself and feared distress. He wanted happiness beyond the reach of danger. So he wandered endlessly. Wherever people said that happiness was found, he longed to go. But wandering took a long, long time. He was the sort of man who loved himself and really dreaded death. He truly wanted release from aging and mortality. Then one day he came to know the truth, abandoning the cause of suffering and compounded things. He found a cave of wonders, of endless happiness, that is, the body. As he gazed throughout the cave of wonders, his suffering was destroyed, his fears appeased. He gazed and gazed around the mountainside, experiencing unbounded peace. He feared if he were to go and tell his friends, they'd say he'd gone insane. He'd better stay alone, engaged in peace, abandoning his thoughts of contact, than to roam around, a sycophant, both criticized and flattered, exasperated and annoyed. So that's his sort of introduction to this long poem, or part of the introduction. There's a few different themes that he draws out. Sankharas are the things of a compounded nature, but particularly the mental sankharas, the thoughts and moods and feelings. So, you can't remedy the changing of sankharas fashioned by kamma. They're out to spite no one. If you grasp hold of them, to push them this way and that, the mind has to become defiled and wrong. Don't think of resisting the natural way of all things. Let good and evil follow their own affairs. We simply free ourselves. Unentangled in sankharas, that's what's peaceful and cool. When you know the truth, you have to let go of sankharas as soon as you see they're changing. When you're weary of them, you let them go easily, with no need to be forced. The Dhamma is cooling. The mind will stop being subjected to things. And that's a flavor of the Thai forest tradition, in the sense of really understanding the nature of the mind, understanding the nature of conditions, and that you don't need to create the perfect conditions. You don't need to, on a certain level, have that having some sort of absolute purity of mind, in the sense of, I've got to make this mind pure, and I've got to hold it like that. It's more like, you understand things in their true nature, and then things fall away. And then another aspect, or another, it continues on. So in brief, there's suffering, and there's the Dhamma, always with the mind. Contemplate this until you see the truth, and the mind will be completely cool. However great the pleasure or pain, they'll cause you no fear. No longer drunk with the cause of suffering, the mind's well gone. Knowing just this much is enough to soothe your fevers and to rest from your search for a path to release. The mind, knowing the Dhamma, forgets the mind attached to dust. The heart, knowing the Dhamma of ultimate ease, sees for sure that the khandhas are always stressful. The khandhas being form, feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness, five aspects of being. The heart, knowing the Dhamma of ultimate ease, sees for sure that the khandhas are always stressful. The Dhamma stays as the Dhamma, the khandhas stay as khandhas, that's all. Which is a lovely expression of the essence of the teachings. Then it goes on. Inconstancy refers to the heart as it moves from its labels. When you see this, watch it again and again, right at the moving. When all external objects have faded away, the Dhamma will appear. When you see that Dhamma, you recover from mental unrest. The mind then won't be attached to dualities. Just this much truth can end the game. Knowing, not knowing, that's the method for the heart. Once we see through inconstancy, the mind's source stops creating issues. All that remains is the primal mind, true and unchanging. Knowing the mind's source brings release from all worry and error. And I'll just read his last sort of winding up the whole poem. This is called the attainment of liberation from the khandhas, a Dhamma that remains in place with no coming or going, a genuine nature, the only one, with nothing to make it stray or spin. With that, the tale is ended. Right or wrong, please ponder with discernment till you know. For that. This is in the Access to Insight, Ajahn. This translation is done by Ajahn Jeff. He consulted with a lot of senior monks to try to really get the... Because Ajahn Mun wrote it probably in early 1930s or something. And so that, of course, language always changes. There's some archaic use of language. And it was in pencil on paper, so it wasn't in... some of it was a little bit unclear. Any questions?
What language was it in, or was Ajahn Mun's speaker on?
I think, you know, Ajahn Mun's first language is Lao. But he was also, you know, he was actually quite learned. And a lot of the learning would take place in Thai also. And he did also spend a lot of, he went back and forth to central Thailand. He spent time in Bangkok. There was another very well-known monk from Ubon, who was a very accomplished scholar, who was also a practitioner, very highly regarded. And so that, you know, probably in terms of normal speaking, probably mostly Lao, but he would have probably been quite in his writing and thinking in terms of writing something that might last for some time. He would probably use more time. That's just a guess.
Another question. During his own time, or you know, throughout the course of his life, did he become well respected, sort of, by the Buddhist establishment, or was he more considered like a renegade and had relatively small groups of students and followers?
He was considered a bit of a, you know, by the. He was outside this, and stayed outside the sphere of the administration as much as he could. It's like, you know, he had a lot of respect. People respected him. He was held in awe. But then he was also, he's kind of a wild card, because he didn't fall into any category. And he didn't make any effort to endear himself to the administration. He was spending time up in the north, and the administrative monks heard about that, and they wanted to do something to try to help people in the north, so they made him the abbot of a very well-known monastery, an ancient monastery in Chiang Mai. And he received word of that. He got notification when he was there, staying at that monastery. Next morning, day he left. He was gone. And then the head monk of the northeast of Thailand was really averse to him and the kind of the forest monk tradition, because he thought that they were wasting their time sitting around. You know, what are they doing? They're not doing anything valuable. They should be at least, you know, contributing to the education tradition system or something. So that they were, that was part of the moving as well, was to keep out of the realm of the administrative system. And it wasn't until the monk who had the most kind of aversion to him, there was always a kind of a tension and conflict going on. It wasn't until he got old, and then one of Ajahn Mun's disciples went to teach him, and then he realized, I just wasted so much time. It was Ajahn Lee Dhammadharma who taught him and trained him in meditation and got him to meditate. Yeah, Rick.
When I was doing some reading on his life, it was also talked that he was doing a lot of teaching to the devas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I just kind of knew, kind of looking at. He would be up in the middle of the night just teaching like that. And so, coming from the Western mind,
yes,
was
there's doubt?
Yeah. A little.
Yeah.
Probably. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, can you share any thoughts on that or whatever, you know, for again, for me or someone this culture and reading that, and it's like, okay, here's this, and just trying to put it together.
Well, I mean, hey, there's some parts of it you just have to realize. Like, you know, personally, myself, I don't have any problem with the idea of devas and the ability of some accomplished beings to be in contact or to teach them, or that they come for teachings. I don't have any problem with it, but I don't have any direct experience. My own temperament is such that I'm not that interested, and I don't have any ability in that direction anyway. So there's no point in being interested. It's a sort of speculation on my part. But I've been around enough teachers and lay people who have a, you know, their range of experience just way beyond what the Western rational materialist is used to experiencing. So. Yeah.
You said something earlier, and I'm trying to wrap my head around how this practice would look like if you didn't. I can't imagine not having meditation as part of it.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, that's the nature of a religion, that it isn't doesn't necessarily turns into empty form, and Buddhism isn't accepted just because we like it. Doesn't mean that, or we see the value in it. Doesn't mean that as a religion, that same pattern doesn't actually happen. So that, certainly by many, many monks, many lay people wouldn't see the value or bother with meditation. They're quite happy with the belief system, a system of ceremony that ties their life together, that gives it meaning, and the opportunity to develop generosity and faith and good actions.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a bad thing, but it's not quite the same. Yeah, John.
This is probably related. I was leaping through a tricycle at the store, but his magazines are too expensive for me to buy. And they had 10 misconceptions about Buddhism that's easy to deal with, like sitting in the grocery store. And one of them was about meditation, and it said that all Buddhists meditate, and it said historically that wasn't true. There was chiefly no monks, and then only relatively recently. And especially in the West, has that become more central to the practice? Do you think that's accurate? And is it partly through the forest tradition that's, and of course the whole Vipassana thing and all that?
Yeah. And the reality is also that, it wasn't, meditation wasn't even seen as necessary for the monks. So it wasn't as if it was something held within the, just within the realm of the monks, but also the lay people. And so it was always a minority in both the lay people as well as the lay community.
Mm.
And I think, nowadays, certainly in Thailand, I see a real increase of interest in meditation, both in terms of the monks as well as the lay community. And maybe even more in the lay community. There's a lot of meditation groups and meditation centers and meditation retreats that are taking place all the time, and or you know groups that meet in places like you know their workplaces, banks, hospitals, government ministries, corporations. I was just talking to a person today who's writing a book, and they were amazed. I gave a talk at the corporate headquarters for 7-Eleven in Thailand. And that's on Silom Road, which is the center for the financial district. And I was in a conference room. There was a couple hundred people there. You know, and it's a weekly meditation group that they have. And I was just there as a guest speaker. And they do chanting and meditation. They just do a Dhamma talk. And that's what they do that at noontime. And there was about 200 people in the conference room that I was in. There was closed circuit to another, probably 150, 200 in another conference room. And then there was a foyer that probably had another 100, 150 people that connected with that. You know, people are interested. Even in the heart of the beast.
Lumpan, did they offer you a big gulp afterwards?
Lumpan, on that topic, it's kind of curious to me because I think in, say, most Westerners come to Dharma practice as meditation.
Right.
And think that, you know, like, look at some of the primary older established centers in this country is all oriented around insight meditation,
yeah.
Or meditation center, meditation, meditation, meditation.
Yeah.
And only lately, it seems, are they bringing in, say, the other elements of practice that aren't just about meditation or, you know, or even some of the other ceremonies or, say, the Buddhist stuff that in Asian countries it's like the opposite.
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting to see. And even here, like people who come to this monastery, like maybe with Ajahn Mun or Ajahn Chah, it's like, okay, well, if you come here, that what you're going to go away with is meditation is a really important part. You can't like do it without meditation. And then Westerners coming here would walk away saying, oh, well, we thought it was only meditation, but now we see that this also involves devotion and generosity. It's like the opposite in a way.
Yeah, and it's something that's really exciting for, like, certainly Ajahn Chah. You know, it's really exciting for him to sort of, you know, come to the West and see West, see, you know, to be able to plant these seeds and kind of extend the and because he also sees that as something that, so there's a lot of cross-pollination that's taking place and kind of mutual encouragement and mutual learning, actually, that takes place by these two different cultures and cultural perspectives meeting each other and learning from each other. Aura.
Just along those lines, one of the great gifts that I've received over the last few years, spending more time has been the sense of devotion.
Yeah.
And how it opens the heart.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, is there a Pali sort of word or teaching other than puja around that principle? I mean, the Buddha has so many lists.
Right. Well, I mean, certainly the you know that when you think of the say like the five spiritual faculties, first one is saddha. And it's faith, but faith isn't just faith from a belief.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of confidence,
mm-hmm.
You know, both in the teaching, the example, the you know, the whole bit.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, for faith to actually fulfill its purpose, it has to result in effort. So then there's an application. So it starts the whole ball rolling. So yeah, I think that's that aspect of, and it's also why you know we're putting it in this under the kind of the big umbrella theme of devotion.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we'll move on to disciple of Ajahn Mun, probably the most well-known disciple in Thailand, certainly, Ajahn Mahabua. And Ajahn Mahabua is considered this very, very strict, very fierce teacher. He's also, he had a really big heart. And this particular picture was found in Ubon, where I trained, in the early 1990s, so that nobody had seen this picture before. There's only a few pictures of Ajahn Mun that exist. So then I had a whole bunch of them made up, and then had monks go, went to the different teachers associated with Ajahn Mun and offered them. So when offered to Ajahn Mahabua, he just lit up, put it up on his shrine and bowed three times. That was his first thing to do with it. He was just really delighted. So I'll turn it over to Ajahn Kunadamo.